Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's been a lot of conjecture about the possibility that what's being uncovered by the Mueller investigations will lead to the eventual impeachment of President Trump. If that happens, Mike Pence, the man Paul Manafort insisted that Mr. Trump should pick as his running mate, will become the 46th president of the United States. So, who is Mike Pence? Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner have written a book that explores just that, The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books, an imprint of St. Martin's Press. They were on our show to discuss it last August, and we thought this might be a good time to rebroadcast that segment. I began by welcoming Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks much.
Until recently, it was thought that a happy coincidence had changed Donald Trump's mind about his running mate, from his first choice, which was Chris Christie, to Mike Pence. But hadn't Manafort actually concocted a story that the candidate's plane had mechanical problems, which forced him to spend the night in Indianapolis and then everything follow from there?
Well, Trump had to stay overnight for a repair that normally takes 45 minutes. So either this is a story concocted by Manafort and agreed to by Trump, and we now know that he concocts everything. We're into almost 5,000 lies for his presidency. Or, you know, they actually pulled one over on him. But either way, it was certain that they wanted this fella to balance out the Trump chaos.
But Mike Pence was, at that point, a rather unpopular governor of Indiana. Peter, why was Manafort so set on him?
Well, there was an obvious reason to, first of all, not choose Christie. And it wasn't only Manafort. It was also Jared Kushner, who had, to put it the least possible, he had no love lost for Chris Christie, because Christie, as a U.S. attorney, had prosecuted Kushner's father, and his father had gone to jail. There was no love there whatsoever. The second thing, I think, was that the idea of balance was definitely at the fore. Trump is Trump, and to have another boisterous loudmouth on the ticket didn't make any sense. Here instead, you've not only got the guy with the good haircut, who everybody says is nice, but also you've got somebody that assures the electorate that the right flank is covered by someone who's polite and also is loyal to the principles of extreme conservatism.
And Michael,
here he is.
Michael, the Koch brothers, for example, were opposed to Donald Trump as a candidate. Did the selection of Pence bring them on board?
Well, it absolutely did open the door for the Kochs and for the whole army of libertarian funders. So he has a long-standing relationship with Betsy DeVos and her brother Eric Prince, the famous mercenary. That whole family has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into Republican campaigns. And DeVos will say outright, you know, I'm not going to mince words. We're trying to buy influence. We're trying to direct policy with this money. And Mike was a famous fundraiser. He was a terrible lawmaker, but he was great at raising money.
Now, how did the two of you come to collaborate on this book? You both have separate careers in broadcast and newspaper journalism, but you were brought together 30 years ago by the legendary Newsday editor Les Payne, whose famous rallying cry was, "Tell the truth and duck." I wonder how the president would have reacted to him.
Well, Michael and I were at Newsday. Indeed, I was the foreign editor, and Michael was working on religion. And And Les suggested to us that we start writing about liberation theology, which was hardly people remembered anymore, but it was the Catholic Church in action to try to support the poor, the option for the poor.
Largely and Michael, a Jesuit group.
Yeah, in part, yeah. And very much opposed to opposed by the latter-day Pope Benedict, who was kind of like Torquemada of the 1980s, and so Michael and I started working on it. Michael was traveling all over Central America, the Philippines, as I recall, Brazil, and we put together, because of him, we put together a fabulous story about religion in the world and what social action meant. And there's really a relationship to what we did back then to what we're doing now. We're very interested in looking at religion and how it operates in the political realm, and that's where we are.
And we'll get to the evangelicals and that part of the story in a moment. You have anything you want to add to that, Michael?
Well, Peter's being very modest. He was my boss, so and he directed me. He's got deep experience in foreign correspondence. We worked very well together and found that we had the same sensitivity to the idea that people are guided by their faith often in the pursuit of politics, and that this is the two things that you're not supposed to talk about. You're not supposed to talk about religion or politics, and we decided to address both.
You begin your book with Mike Pence being sworn in using Ronald Reagan's Bible by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Was Justice Thomas his choice? Yes.
Was Justice Thomas Mike's choice?
Yes.
Very much so.
Why Justice Thomas? There were any number of other conservatives on the court.
Probably because he's considered to be the most conservative of all choices, and number two to the real justice that Mike respected, Scalia, who had just died. So there's every reason to choose him with great respect and a signal to his love for the conservative movement.
Well, you also have to give him credit. He used a Bible. He didn't hesitate. Donald Trump wanted to use the art of the deal and had to be talked out of it. So at least, you know, Mike is traditional in many ways, and at least in that moment, he did the normal thing.
After the swearing in, he took his what you call humility pose. What does that look like?
Well, Mike's humility pose, I always imagine an undertaker in a town of about 30,000 people. You know, this practice seriousness, and you see it often when he's standing behind the president. You know, if he's not beaming, and when he's beaming, he reminds everyone of Nancy Reagan looking at Ron, that big wide-eyed look of almost ecstasy. When he's not doing that, he has his mouth set in a straight line. You can't guess what he's thinking, but you assume that he's being serious, and I imagine his mind is wandering all over the place.
How central has Mike Pence been in developing the alliance between evangelical leaders and Republican politicians?
He's really been at the heart of it. That's the real reason that he's there. Up until this moment, Mike is the one that's showing that Donald Trump is acceptable despite all of his venality, because he's the herald to the world of the future for his group of evangelicals. That is this group of right wing fundamentalists that are expecting that they are coming to the fore, and Mike is Trump for them is almost like the herald, almost like Elijah, the herald for the future, and they see themselves the chosen, and the chosen are being brought in by means of Donald Trump, no matter who he is.
In doing that, hasn't Pence tried to position the Republican Party as the party of believers in the culture wars versus the non-believers in the Democratic Party?
Well, that's absolutely true.
But there are Christians in the Democratic Party and Jews.
Of course, and we hear—
Even a Muslim.
We hear from them. You know, when we talk about Pence's claim to the definition of Christianity, we get a lot of pushback if we don't acknowledge that Christianity is this very broad river, and there are lots of tributaries contributing to it and people of faith of all different sorts. But Pence, his three elements are guns, God, and money. So he's decided he's on the far right with the gun issue and all that culture it implies. He's embraced conservative evangelicalism, and he's a voracious consumer of political money.
And Pence is supported by some mega donors who you found believe they're victims even at a time of historic inequality because the government wouldn't get out of their way and let them get richer.
Well, is there ever enough? You know, this is what the Koch brothers are all about.
So the Koch brothers think that they're victims?
Oh, yes. They think they're overregulated, that the terrible environmentalists are somehow hamstringing them. And it's why you have the head of the EPA saying that America must go out and harvest natural resources, that God intends for us to pull absolutely everything out of the ground and burn it up.
Do many on the Christian right also see themselves as victims?
That's actually the sales pitch. And any criticism of Mike Pence is the first thing to say, here they come again, the liberals that are attacking us, we have to protect ourselves. It's kind of like an extension of the really ridiculous campaign that Bill O'Reilly and company were on, saying that there's a war on Christmas. You know, it's the same kind of, you know, they're out to get us. And what it really does with the people who are of faith, it kind of tells them that they're being threatened. And I think, and others think, that this use of victimization is a sign of future authoritarian control. I mean, first you say we're victims, and eventually you say we've got to fight. Now, take a look. This past week, Trump had 100 evangelicals at the White House, And he kind of weaponized or tried to weaponize these evangelicals, saying, if you don't go to the pulpit and support us, and if we lose in November, there's going to be violence from the left, violence from the Democrats. That's the kind of weaponization. And by the way, Mike Pence was there. He was silent.
One of the evangelical leaders, is his name Jeffers?
Yes.
He says that it all began when the Supreme Court decided that you couldn't have prayer in schools. But prayer in schools, the Supreme Court's decision is perfectly sensible when you look at the Constitution, which says you can't institute a national religion, however it says it.
Well, and Mike Pence is lonesome for those days when the colonies actually had established churches. We have a scene in the book where he goes to give a campaign address, and he starts talking about how wonderful it was when there was a state religion in places like the Virginia Commonwealth and in Massachusetts. And this is all pre-revolutionary days, you know, prior to the Declaration of Independence. So there is this confusion, I think, in Mike Pence's heart about whether he's an American or not.
Does his presence in the administration allow evangelicals to ignore the Trump scandals, although they condemned Bill Clinton's for his Monica Lewinsky affair?
Oh, boy, you know, that's something that Pence did specifically. He was a radio host before he was elected to Congress, and he had diatribes about Bill Clinton, about how he must be impeached because he had lied to the American people about these affairs. He also said at that time that infidelity should be punishable by law. And his extreme positions, I think, do stake out the idea that these infidelities are somehow grievous. But in Trump's case, they're not.
He also claimed that cigarette smoking doesn't cause cancer.
Right. And he doesn't believe that evolution is a scientific fact. He's discounted and really dismisses the science around climate change. He is a throwback person. He's talked about himself as the frozen man from another era. And I think that is how he imagines himself to be.
That sounds almost like a self-put-down.
Well, it's interesting. He has got a certain charm. The bumpers for his radio show would be things like, and now back to Mike Pence, the man who would have been James Bond if only his mother allowed him to be. He likes to poke fun at himself. He's charming. He's a good retail politician.
Was he similar to Rush Limbaugh in his approach to radio?
Rush Limbaugh on
Because he has said that Rush Limbaugh was a really important factor in his decision to run for Congress.
I think he had all of Limbaugh's positions, but stated in a pleasant way.
I'm speaking with Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner. Their book, The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. Mike Pence has dreamed of being in the Oval Office for pretty much his whole life. Didn't he? Even in public school, didn't he say that he assumed someday he'd be president of the United States?
Yes, indeed. Everything about Mike has been this goal, and he's protected himself, and he's been careful and very disciplined, really, in trying not to make any mistakes to be able to be found out for anything other than the true blue straight-lined person that we see. He very much saw himself, certainly throughout his conversion from Catholicism into evangelicalism, to be a person that is going to move systematically toward a political career that brings him to the White House. He had an image of it, and he told his friends in college that that's where he was going, if not earlier.
But does he see any irony in the fact that he has hitched his wagon to a man with some serious scandals in his personal history?
We talked to his closest aides about that, and by the way, we tried to talk to him, and we got a two-step non-answer and didn't. But some aides, speaking off the record, we asked the obvious question: how can it be this man that professes such Christian values and kindness and such things like that? How can he sign on with someone the likes of Donald Trump? What does he think about it? What does he believe? And the answer was simply, Mike prayed when he was offered the job. He prayed carefully. He knew what he was getting into, and once he made the decision to go there, he took it with eyes wide open, and he's going to stick with it. And if anything ever changes, he'll be ready for that change. So he actually goes to the extent of trying to tell his people that he's bringing Donald Trump toward God. He keeps mentioning considerable number of speeches around the country that Trump always asks him for a prayer. Trump is thinking about the power of prayer. Those of us that don't believe that don't believe that Mike thinks it either.
Well, and this is one of the great problems with Mike Pence. You asked if he recognizes the irony. I'm not sure he knows what irony is, because he's the least aware of his intellectual conflicts. He just doesn't seem to care that he's in some cases lying outright, as Donald Trump does. He did an interview recently where he said, "Well, I never imagined I'd be vice president. I'd never imagined I'd gotten this far." And we quote people who've heard him say it throughout his life: "God intends me to be president. When I'm inaugurated, I'd like to have the ceremony on the shady side of the Capitol, not the sunny side." This is a man who's every bit as ambitious as Donald Trump ever has been.
It's been suggested by some that he actually is happy that Trump is having these problems, because if Trump ever is forced to resign or is impeached, then he becomes president.
Well, here's something for everyone to contemplate. Mike Pence could become president, say, next year, and then be elected and reelected and be the second longest serving president after FDR. If things cut right for him, and they actually could. I think Donald Trump is so besieged. We see today he's spreading conspiracy theories, new conspiracy theories about NBC and Lester Holt. There's every sign that he's in deep trouble, and I can imagine him just leaving office and leaving it to Mike. And as Mike's aides say, he's ready to step in.
And how much day-to-day involvement does Mike Pence have in coming up with policy? Is he an important factor in this administration? Because many vice presidents are kind of just, you know,
potted plants.
Yes.
Day to day, you have to take a look at the context in which he's operating. The White House is in chaos and under siege, and the people closest to Trump are they don't know what to do. I mean, just dealing with Trump is enough. Pence is there. He's sitting next to him whenever he's in town. There's a longer range thing going on. First of all, he's been able to fulfill the promise of Donald Trump Jr. To John Kasich. If you're vice president, you'll be the most powerful vice president in history, he said to Kasich. Kasich rejected that out of hand. But Mike Pence is showing that prediction is true. He has his people in very key points around the administration, in the Department of Health, Medicare, Medicaid, which alone is like more than a quarter of the national budget. Pompeo, of course, Betsy DeVos, for whom Pence cast the deciding vote, so that she could become Secretary of Education. So his own people are day by day working in places that Trump is not really that interested. He's there, and he made decisions about who might be the Supreme Court nominee, and he's out there supporting Kavanaugh, not understanding why he's not being respected as he should, and just breeze through 100-0 in the Senate.
I was wondering about his take on this latest business about NAFTA. Wasn't he a strong supporter of NAFTA?
Absolutely. He was, because the farmers in Indiana ship a lot of their product overseas. Indiana has a very strong manufacturing base, in part because it's a low-wage state. There are very few union organizers in Indiana, so manufacturers love to locate there. They all depend on NAFTA and other free trade agreements. And until he aligned himself with Donald Trump, Pence was one of the most ardent free traders in Congress. It was an article of faith for him that there should be no barriers to trade anywhere in the world.
So has he been questioned about the change? You say that he is a notorious flip-flopper.
Well, you tell me, have you ever seen Mike Pence interviewed about anything? When we started this project, we were shocked to discover that this man, who had been in public life since 1988, had not submitted to one in-depth interview in any medium.
So we have no idea how he is dealing with the Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal stories.
Well, we do know that Karen Pence was completely beside herself over the notorious Access Hollywood tape at the end of the campaign. And there, we think, is good evidence that Mike contemplated trying to flip the ticket, trying to put himself in the position of the presidential candidate and demote Trump to vice president, or perhaps even just bolting, resigning from the ticket. But in the end, they hung in there because, you know, there is this reverse engineering that they often do. They'll say, I made this decision, and then a moment later, it's because God led me to make the decision. So if God led me to make the decision, who am I to go against him now? So if just happens to serve your ambition, well, that's a happy accident.
Well, it's been suggested that since Pence believes God has big plans for him, that he is going to be president sometime in the future. And it's because God wants him to be president. Now, I was wondering about his wife, Karen. Didn't he criticize her because she had been, when they first met, because she had been previously married, or was that another woman, and was no longer a virgin?
That's what we heard, you know, from friends of his at college, that he went back to the fraternity house, having met Karen and fallen in love, and explained to his friends that, well, I'm going to forgive her for not being a virgin because I love her. Now,
she had been married.
This is the 1980s.
Surprising,
right?
She
had been married and divorced. They met at church. She was every bit as religious as he was, but this was a difficult decision for him.
you have to wonder what she thinks about all of this, considering the fact that he did dump her for at one point and then decided to forgive her.
Yes, and I think that she is, in many ways, appalled by Donald Trump, but her ambition is great. During the 1990s, Mike had announced that he was leaving politics for good, going into broadcasting, and he did stay out of partisan activities, but Karen did not. She continued to host fundraisers for candidates, continued to talk to the people who mattered, and keep these relationships alive.
So on the one hand, you get the sense that Pence believes that women should not play as strong a role in the world as men. And on the other hand, she seems to be the one who kept him in the game.
Yeah, that's very much the case. And as far as who she really is and what she really thinks or what Mike really thinks, they're very guarded and very disciplined about what they want people to hear. And we're not going to hear even from friends of hers that she may speak to. They're very cautious. But you get this hint of this very traditional relationship tied in with a dependency that's very odd. There was something very humorous that we were looked at when we saw Mike becoming governor of Indiana. The first day in 2013, he brought in the reporters and he pointed to a telephone and he said, "That's my connection to Karen." And it turned out that Karen had been moved into the governor's mansion. In the governor's office for the first time, a first lady had an office right there in the state house, and she had her own hot phone on a newly designed desk in a newly designed office so that they would be able to communicate. Of course, 2013, we already had cell phones. It wouldn't have needed a hotline to do that. But there she was, you know, right, at arm's length whenever he needed her. So there's some kind of relationship there that it's hard to scan beyond these tidbits. And of course, everybody knows that he's referred to her as mother, which is something that came out. And it's kind of, there's a quaint element to it because it's kind of like a rural Indiana type way of talking about one's spouse. But one doesn't know quite what to make of that either.
Well, and one other thing that I think is fascinating about their relationship is that it actually mirrors the Clintons. This is a strange truth about them. So you have in Bill and Hillary a couple where he respected her immensely, especially respected her judgment politically, her policy chops. And Karen has been Mike's first advisor throughout his entire life. She pedaled a bicycle beside him on the bike tour when he first ran for Congress. She had this red phone on her desk. He had the red phone on his desk. No one ever really mentions this, but they are as much a power couple and a modern example of a couple that shares a great deal of power in the same way that the Clintons were.
Despite presenting themselves as a traditional marriage, old-fashioned traditional marriage.
I don't think it's so traditional. I think, you know, their lust for power, well, you know, we can go back into Greek mythology and find that men and women alike lust for power. And I think in their case, it's very true.
My guests are Michael D'Antonio, the author of The Truth About Trump and more than a dozen other books. You can see him regularly on CNN. He also writes for a number of newspapers.
I'm a busy fellow.
And
so is Peter.
Peter Eisner is the author, most recently, of MacArthur's Spies. He has worked at the Washington Post, Newsday, Associated Press. They have collaborated on a book called The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, which is a Thomas Dunn Books imprint of St. Martin's Books. I just wonder about a politician who was so unpleasant to so many people and so unpopular. I thought most politicians are glad-handers, but when he was in college, he also turned in his Phi Gam fraternity brothers for boozing and sneaking around. And how did the college respond to that?
They rewarded him. So, you know, what's amazing about Mike is he is a guy who has his goal in mind. And in this case, I think he imagined that he wanted a job with the college when he graduated, wanted good recommendations from the administration. He became president of the fraternity simply to have something on his resume, I think. And when the dean of students showed up at the door asking if there was a keg in the house, Mike opened the door and said, "Why, yes, there it is, and there are my brothers." And they all got punished for it, and yet, you know, Mike considered this a badge of honor when everyone else thought he was, to quote the president, a rat.
Did you speak with any of his former fraternity brothers about what it was he was like in college?
I did, and, you know, he never attended any of the stag films shown in the basement. And he led a group, a faith group on campus. And part of this, he preached, he sang, he led the group in prayer. And they would give testimony about their moment of coming to Jesus. And I spoke to one woman who didn't give good enough testimony. And he told her that she was deficient in her faith. It crushed her. And then he excoriated her for her sinful ways, which included attending parties at his fraternity. So the hypocrisy there is just rampant.
And he also shamed a friend who came out to him as gay.
Yeah, this fellow, I'm not sure he's over it yet. He was his neighbor on the same floor of the fraternity house. This was a time when coming out was really difficult. Very few people took that step on this college campus. It was a very religious environment. And Mike was his mentor. He considered Mike the guy who would tell him how to proceed through life, and he trusted him. And Mike's response was that, "You're no longer my friend."
It's important for us to mention with all this. Look, we're taking an X-ray of Mike Pence. What are the building blocks of the man who became vice president and who is now a breath or a Big Mac or an indictment away from the presidency? And these things are all telling. But the fact is that a person of faith is a person of faith. Fine. What we're looking at is mixing faith with political doctrine and politicizing one's religious beliefs in what's supposed to be a multifaceted society in which everybody gets to play, not just those who say that this should be a Christian nation. That's where the change is.
And you describe him as presenting himself as a deeply moral man, but then write that his record indicates some ruthlessness and comfort with aggression.
No question about that.
Can you give us some examples of the ruthlessness?
Well, sure. Let's take a look at what he was doing as governor of Indiana, for instance. There's an incipient HIV outbreak in southern Indiana in 2015. The Centers for Disease Control and local doctors are saying this is being caused by the sharing of hypodermic needles among opioid users, and it's something that's getting to be really dangerous. Mike waited 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. The number of cases increased, and he refused to do what they were asking, which was to establish a needle exchange, which was illegal under state law. Finally, this is a deeply conservative state with deeply conservative officials. Asks a local sheriff, "Well, what should I do?" The sheriff finally said, "We've got to do this." Mike prays for a while, and then finally, months later, after the first outbreak, then finally allows a limited temporary needle exchange. Meanwhile, people were dying. There was benign neglect there, and there are many other cases like this during his 4 years as governor, and there are many more.
Well, it's been suggested that he might not have been reelected governor of Indiana if he hadn't run as Trump's running mate.
Well, I think that's true. Many people in Indiana thought that despite the great advantage Republicans have in voter registration, Mike had been such a lackluster governor, and he had One major controversy, among others, that really alienated the business community. He pushed for, and the legislature passed, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA it was called, that was essentially a license to discriminate against gay people. And it was telling business owners, you can refuse to serve anybody on the basis of faith, and you can say that any prejudice is a matter of faith. The uproar around this was immediate and nationwide. There were teams in the NCAA that said, we're not coming to Indiana because of this law. There were associations that were going to cancel conventions. So you had Eli Lilly, the big pharmaceutical company headquartered in Indianapolis, Cummins Engine, which is in Mike's hometown of Columbus, other firms step forward and say, we can't have this. This is not who we are.
And wasn't there also a water crisis that kind of similar to what happened in Flint?
Very similar to what happened in Flint in East Chicago, which is in the northwest corner of Indiana. It's one of the few places that is black majority. It's also heavily Democratic. And Mike just decided not to act. And his successor came in and immediately acted, not only on that item, but on commuting the sentence and the conviction of an infamous prisoner who had been wrongly convicted of a murder and had requested and received the parole board's approval for his to be exonerated, and Mike just refused to do it.
And let's understand who his successor was. It was his deputy governor, Eric Holcomb, who then had taken over and ran for governor and won the office.
So it wasn't this a Democrat. It was another Republican.
It was his guy.
A supermajority of conservative Republicans, of whom Eric Holcomb was one. And the legislature, the governor, the others, many of them quietly and tacitly saw Mike as too extremist for them. And these were cases of it. And here we are, instead of having a governor who might not have been reelected and might have been out of politics, is the Vice President of the United States.
I remember when he was actually the object of some ridicule after he signed a law imposing new limits on abortion. Women started sending him messages about their menstrual flow, their cramps, their birth control, their tampon discomfort, their bloating, their menopause, and they called their campaign Periods for Pence.
And, you know, it was both a statewide and a nationwide effort to make sure that his office was flooded with calls by people saying, you know, I'm not miscarrying. You don't have to have a funeral for my miscarriage. It's just my period.
So it was actually the law required miscarried fetuses to be interred and cremated by a facility having possession of the remains, regardless of the age of the fetus. You had to cremate a miscarried fetus.
Right. This was overturned by the courts, but it's part and parcel of Mike's aggressive attitude toward reproductive rights. And, you know, there's one episode that we write about extensively that doesn't get much attention, and it's the bankruptcy of the Pence family business. This is one thing that he has in common with Donald Trump, a massive bankruptcy. In Indiana, $100 million debt, which is what the Pence company rolled up, is quite substantial. And when it occurred, very few people understood that these shops called Tobacco Road convenience stores and gas stations were actually largely owned by Mike Pence and his family. And they were run by his brother, who's now running for Congress. Not only did the Pences walk away from this debt, they walked away from a $20 million environmental cleanup bill, which then Governor Mitch Daniels agreed to have the state pay. So this idea that he is an upright citizen, that he takes responsibility, there's a lot that runs counter to that claim.
He also had a relationship with Charles Colson of Watergate fame.
Considered him a mentor.
Now, this is a man who was caught in a terrible political scandal.
Right. What Colson went on to be a prison ministry fellow, an evangelist. He's regarded as kind of a remade man, a reborn man, and a hero in evangelical circles. But Mike claims to have what must be by now more than 100 mentors. Every powerful man that Mike ever met, he praises as a mentor, because I think he's always cultivating favors, always trying to align himself with people that could help him later on.
Well, Colson, after he had his religious conversion, wrote that there may be an inevitable showdown between church and state. Is that something that Pence also subscribes to?
This is widely believed in his side of the culture war. Mike has never said there's going to be this showdown, but it's clear that many on the Christian right are preparing for it.
Do we know what the president's ardent supporters all think of Pence? The ones who come to the rallies, is it Trump-Pence, or is it Trump and Pence just happens to be the vice president?
Well, it's interesting. Pence is working on that. He realizes that, and the people around him realize that he doesn't have the firepower and the pizzazz that attracts the Trump base. At the same time, that elements of the Trump base, as we've said, depend on Pence as the good boy in the room, saying, "I've got this." In terms of faith, We're in a good position. Don't worry about it. But at the same time, Pence is the one that's going all around the United States, supported by Trump's dark money organization of America First Policies, which was founded by Brian Parscale, the famous Trump Tower database guru, along with the man who is now Mike's chief of staff, Nick Ayers, and then Corey Lewandowski, also involved, and others that whose names people have heard in the course of looking at the corruption questions around Donald Trump. So what's going on is this organization is sending Mike every week all around the United States with a message of greetings from the president. We've done more than anybody has ever done in the history of the United States for the good of the real people that haven't been heard, make America great again, etc. At the same time, Mike, in so doing, is bringing himself to these places. He's glad-handing the locals. He's doing local radio, local television, such. And one could easily see that he's creating the basis for his own candidacy. And should anything happen, should Trump falter, there he is out there, already known to all of these people, and a safe, friendly face at a time of crisis, if that should happen.
And his chief of staff is next in line to be the president's chief of staff, Nick Ayers?
Potentially so. They've talked about that. Ayers has jumped between the White House and is very close to the White House staff, along with being the chief of staff for Mike, but he's very organized and very methodical in ways that the White House staff has been thrown into chaos by contrast. So not sure that he would actually become chief of staff looking at the situation. Yeah, but his name has come up.
I'm speaking with Peter Eisner and Michael D'Antonio, the co-authors of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, here on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. You wanted to say something more about that, Mike?
Well, I think one of the things that you can see with Mike Pence is that he is a more effective conventional politician than Donald Trump ever will be. He's organized across the 50 United States. He's been pursuing this goal of building personal relationships with funders, but also people all the way down to precinct captains in every state. So he's ready in ways that Trump wasn't when he began running for president.
I've been surprised by how many establishment Republicans have gone on the cable news shows to criticize this administration. A perfect example is what happened after Mike Pence appeared with Sheriff Joe Arpaio, conservative columnist George Will declared that Mike Pence is, quote, America's most repulsive public figure. And after noting how Pence was, quote, oozing unctuousness from every pore, Will warned of the danger of his right-wing Christian populism, adding, Pence, one of evangelical Christians' favorite pinups, genuflex at various altars as the mobocratic spirit and the vicious portion require. Forgive me for not being able to read George Will's tortured prose better. But anyway, the point is that here we have somebody who's a conservative who feels this guy's too conservative.
Yeah, that's not Paul Krugman writing
no.
or Frank Bruni. This is George Will. And I think that lots of folks in conventional Republican circles recoil at both Trump and Pence. And, you know, Mike is the fellow who's always either absent or silent. So when you have Roy Moore running in Alabama and Trump out there stumping for him, Mike says nothing. You have Trump locking up kids in cages and separating from their parents on the border, Mike says nothing. Pence once spoke out against a religious test for people entering the United States and said a ban on Muslims would be unconstitutional. Trump does it. Mike says nothing. So this is a man of no conscience, not a man of conscience.
Now, you mentioned that you weren't able to get a whole bunch of people to speak on the record, but you got a lot of people talking to you, including, I'm sure, some people who are in the inner circle. But you were able to get some. You got former Senator Richard Lugar, former members of Congress Phil Sharp and Barron Hill, and Stephen Moore of the Heritage Foundation to talk about him. What did they tell you?
Well, I think a lot of them were, to some degree, nonplussed when it came to Mike's success. He would not have been the man most likely to succeed in the year 2000 when, for example, Moore's group drafted him as one of the first candidates to back with Koch money and push through. But he had some of the basic elements. He looked decent. He could speak well. He was willing to take orders and follow the libertarian ideology as closely as anyone else. So someone like Stephen Moore is pleased to see Mike Pence where he is. Others who were in Congress with him say that he was not the kind of person they ever trusted. Not someone they really respected.
And he wasn't a very effective legislator.
Well, he never authored a single piece of legislation that succeeded. He couldn't even get an anti-child pornography bill passed. He just is not devoted to lawmaking or to governing in the way that you'd imagine a member of Congress would be.
He also spoke to journalists who followed him in Indiana. What was their take on him?
Oh, I think they're shocked that he's gotten this far.
Definitely, definitely. They found him to be a faker, really, in lots of ways. You know, one favorite line that people would the reporters would groan at when they were at the State House would be when Pence would try to say, "Let me be perfectly clear." Almost sounds like other presidents of the past. But as soon as he said, "Let me be perfectly clear," they knew that he was going to start to obfuscate and not say anything clear whatsoever. They found him to be somewhat disengaged as governor as well, and not really paying that much attention to the job. And really, let's take a look at what we've heard throughout. This was a man who went to law school, was disinterested in the law, really never worked as a lawyer for very long, and not at a very high level. Ran for Congress twice, didn't make it. Became honed his skills as a public speaker and as a personality on radio, and a little bit on TV. Then served six terms in Congress, never successfully got through any bill. And then it seemed that first of all, John Boehner might have told him at some point, you know, you're not really going anywhere in Congress. And then he and his family and his friends looked at needing to check off a point on the resume as administrative experience, and why not run for governor, which he did. And he's not going to be a memorable governor in Indiana history. So here we have somebody that skated through, didn't leave a shadow very much, became one of the icons of the Tea Party, and was rescued from possible defeat into the vice presidency in an improbable combination of events in 2016, and here we are.
But isn't one of his successes that he pushed for voter suppression? And that legacy will be in Indiana until perhaps the courts overturn it. But for the moment, that's something that is going to help an awful lot of other people from his party for a long time. He's not the only governor who did that.
Yeah, that it's definitely the case. And it's a trend of governors and state houses, Republican state houses around the United States, and his Secretary of State, Connie Lawson, famously pushed voter suppression, and they pushed cases in 2016 against voter registration drives in African American majority areas around Indianapolis, and of course. Their attempts were never went any place in doing that, but his Secretary of State still now under the current governor continues to push voter suppression. And of course, Mike later, working with other colleagues, became the head of Trump's really fraudulent voter fraud commission. In 2017, which was disbanded as really a ridiculous exercise in something that has never existed. So yes, Pence is connected to all these things, but always in such cases, and in any case in which there's controversy, he always tends to be able to hang back a little bit. So even in the voter case, you can't exactly say, well, where are his fingerprints there? He just kind of protects himself. Mary Madeline, Dick Cheney's former counselor, I love the quote that she said. He's always in the right place at the right time, she said. Discreet, dedicated, and freakishly absent from tumultuous events.
It's occurring to me more and more that perhaps one of the most important political figures in American history was Eldridge Gerry. there's got to be a book there sometime.
Absolutely. So, you know, and I think what Peter's observing about Mike is this gift for rhetoric. You know, he'll get on a high horse about something like voter fraud. And then when it's discovered that it doesn't exist, he's nowhere to be found. With the Tea Party, he was one of those people who would stand in front of the Tea Party rallies and bellow about Nancy Pelosi, and yet there was nothing accomplished after the rhetoric was issued. He's a star of this speechifying circuit where you go out and you lambaste the liberals, but you don't actually put forward any program.
Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner's book, The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, is published by Thomas Dunn Books. And thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks a lot, Leonard.
That brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner, to Angela Sheldon, who produced this segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls today. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.